This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning into the Planet Microcap Podcast. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's B-O-B-B-Y-K-K-R-A-F-T. You are listening to episode 13 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Before we get started with part two of the episode, Microcap Investing in Canada, I wanted to catch you up on what we featured on StockNewsNow.com recently. We featured articles highlighting video interviews with the following companies: Pressure Biosciences Inc., PBIO on the OTCQB, FinJan Holdings Inc., FNJN on the NASDAQ, Validion Corporation, VLDI on the OTCQB, IFAN Financial Inc., IFAN on the OTCBB, Ascent Solar Technologies Inc., ASTI on the NASDAQ, and Galmed Pharmaceuticals Limited, GLMD on the NASDAQ, as well as a Wall Street View video interview with Nick Hodge from The Outsider Club. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, we're picking up where we left off from my part one conversation with Chip Maloney, frequent contributor to MicrocapClub.com, Brandon Mackey from Small Cap Discoveries, and Philippe Belanger from eSpaceMC.com. As I said last time, we covered a lot of information during our roundtable, so I thought it would be best to separate the interview into two parts. In part two, we discuss whether the due diligence process is different when researching Canadian companies versus US companies, speaking with management, their advice for aspiring microcap investors, and more. Thank you again for tuning into episode 13 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy part two of my interview with Chip, Brandon, and Philippe, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A comprehensive streaming of market data, research, and portfolio management application for you. QuoteStream is a real-time streaming quotes and research system designed for the day trader, retail investor, institutional investor, both new and old. QuoteStream offers low latency, tick-by-tick data, advanced charting, comprehensive technical analysis, news, and research. With no software to install and no servers to maintain, QuoteStream is the ideal solution for you. Go to StockNewsNow.com and start your free 7-day trial. Click the QuoteStream banner in the header or real-time quotes in the nav bar to get started building and managing your investments.
In this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, we're picking up where we left off in part one of my interview with Chip Maloney, frequent contributor to MicrocapClub.com, Brandon Mackey from Small Cap Discoveries, and Philippe Belanger from eSpaceMC.com. We're starting off with our guest backgrounds from part one and then continuing on with our discussion.
Yes, I'm Phil Belanger, and I'm the co-founder and co-owner of eSpace Microcaps. So my background, well, I've always been interested in ways to make money investing actively. It might not qualify as investing, but I started to accumulate capital playing online poker in my early 20s. I was playing part-time while studying in finance. Poker is a lot like investing. You have to make decisions with imperfect information in a timely manner. So when a former colleague of mine introduced me to microcaps about two and a half years ago, it caught my attention. I felt I could have a structural advantage over the professionals, which have much more capital than me, because of the relative illiquidity of microcaps. Plus, it seems like no one cared about profitable and growing non-resource companies. I started with two investments, and I multiplied my capital five times, and I was hooked. I was like, oh, well, I love microcaps, and I want to get better at this. And I started a blog, eSpace Microcaps, so I can share my investing ideas and educational articles about microcap investing. So that's about it.
Cool. And Chip, how about you?
Yeah, I've got a background in healthcare. I graduated from university in the late 90s, and when I started check. My first investment was in a tech fund right at the top of the bubble, and within about 6 months, I lost 50% of the value of that investment. And so it was cheap tuition, but I thought there's got to be a better way than this. So I went to the library. One of the first books I picked up was a book by Janet Lowe on the wit and wisdom of Warren Buffett. And it took me about a half hour to flip through the book, and it just made perfect sense to me. And shortly after that, I was reading a quote from Warren Buffett. I think it was a, one of his annual meetings, and someone asked him a question about if he had to go back and start investing $1 million, what would he do? And his answer was basically similar to what he did in the early Buffett partnerships. He kind of started at the letter A and flipped through Moody's manuals and all the way through Z looking for mispriced small companies. And so from there, after that, the second thing that kind of cemented it for me, that microcaps were the place to invest, I read a book by James O'Shaughnessy. It was called What Works on Wall Street. And he's got a chapter in there that looks at the returns by market cap. And his study going back 50 years found that companies that have a market cap of 25 million or less tend to vastly outperform all the other deciles of asset classes and equities. So that kind of cemented it for me. And those were kind of my influences that steered me towards microcaps.
And you're also a contributor to the microcapclub.com, right?
Yeah, you bet. And also Philippe and Matthew's blog. I'm going to hack this. It's called Espace MC.
All right. And Brandon, I know we just did an interview in Philly, but you know, for our audience that may not have watched it yet, what's your background and how'd you get into microcaps?
Sure. So I'm a chemical engineer by training. I was graduating my last semester in school. I was studying abroad, and I'd always really wanted to get into investing one way or another, and I was reading, I started with Jim Cramer's books, which perhaps wasn't the best place to start for microcap value investing, but I bought my first stock when I was just weeks away from graduating. It was a rare earth metals company that's now bankrupt, so it wasn't off to a good start, but there was something that really kept me interested, and luckily, as soon as I got back from my last semester and I picked up the essays of Warren Buffett, Little Green Book, that I read through in a matter of hours because everything in there just made so much sense. And I immediately changed course from what I had learned in my first few months and really focused on things that had just been sold off. So, you know, if the stock was down 40% on some headline news, and it was a real business, I would buy into those kind of things. And you know, 9 times out of 10, they would reverse. I would make some money. It got me interested, and I just kept at it, and eventually found my way into microcaps because there were a lot of bloggers that I followed that really advocated for them. And somewhere along the way, I said, "Hey, why don't I start my own blog? I think I'm getting the handle of this a little bit." And I started a blog called Motology, based on taking Warren Buffett's framework of companies with competitive advantages and trying to find them in the small niche parts of the market. And through that blog, developed a following, and ended up getting together with another investor up in Canada, Paul Andriola. We said, why don't we merge kind of what we're doing? He had a forum, I had the blog, into a newsletter. It's called Small Cap Discoveries, and we're all about finding Canada's next emerging growth stories. And somewhere along the way, I also worked at a hedge fund, so gained some experience doing that, and now focusing on the newsletter.
That was everyone's background from part one. And now we continue with part two of microcap investing in Canada. Alrighty, so, you know, when it comes to due diligence and research, how's the process different when researching Canadian companies compared to US companies? And Brandon, let's start with you on this one.
Okay, so I started, you know, as a US investor, and I think largely when you're doing due diligence, you're trying to make sure that the company that you're investing in meets your criteria, that you believe it's attractively priced, and that it has attractive, you know, mid to long term prospects. And so I think from that point of view, it is the same. You know, all business analysis is at the core the same of what you're trying to find out. how you get there is a little bit different. You know, for example, in the U.S., SEC filings tend to be far longer and have far more dense material packed into them than the reports in Canada. So just from a time perspective, and I was very sensitive to this, having a full-time engineering job when I was getting off the ground, is it can really take a long time to get through these reports. You know, the 10Ks, 10Qs, I'd like to go back, you know, 5-7 years and see how things have changed over time, and to go through each of those reports per company can take many, many, many hours. And one thing I like in Canada is the reports, they're a lot smaller, they're a lot more digestible, especially the language that's used. But I also don't feel like you're losing a lot of key information. All the core, you know, financial statements, the color around the management discussion, I found it to not be lacking in Canada. But in the U.S., it's all there, but you have to do a lot of work to kind of distill it all down. So I think there's a lot of time difference when researching the two. But beyond that, I think it's largely the same. You know, you've got companies in both. There's not a whole lot of language barrier. You know, a lot of the companies in the U.S. still have similar companies in Canada. And at the core, you're just trying to understand if this investment is right for your strategy and, you know, attractive for profitable opportunity.
And Chip, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Brandon when he talks about, you know, the reports and disclosures being less in Canada. There's one thing I've found to, if I do want more information on a company, not all, but a lot of companies publish, it's called an annual information form, the AIF. And I find if you go into that and you want the more detail from on the company, just gives you a lot more detail, background on the company, its roots, competition within the industry. The second thing that I think is different, the kind of sister website to SEDAR is SETI, and it's basically where insiders file their transactions. So if they're buying or selling securities.
Hey, Chip, what's that? What's that website again?
It's called SETI, S-E-D-I. Sorry, okay. I apologize. I've got a cold right now. Security for Electronic Disclosure for Insiders, I think it stands for. And, I mean, this, it's probably built on, like, 30-year-old technology, and it's just so hard to navigate. Yeah. So what I generally use is a site called CanadianInsider.com, and they update insider transactions daily on there, and I think it's pretty accurate. You know, I think management at Canadian microcap companies, they're pretty accessible. I'm sure it's similar to in the U.S. You know, I can probably count on one hand the number of times that management wouldn't talk to me when I reached out to them. So so I think in general, the due diligence process other than that is probably pretty similar.
All right, so Chip, I'm going to get back to that point, actually. That was you're leading into my next question. But I wanted to hear Philippe's comment real quick on when it comes to due diligence on, you know, the differences between Canadian and U.S. companies. So I believe you had one point you wanted to make on that, right, Philippe?
Yeah, I've got 2 points actually. The first one would be that in Canada we have maybe lower regulatory rules, so sometimes maybe we have to be more cautious with Canadian companies to make sure it's not a fraudulent company. And the second point I would add is about accounting, because in Canada we use a different set of accounting rules called IFRS. Instead of U.S. GAAP, so sometimes we have to make sure that we understand what's in the financial statements and how they present the information.
So okay, all right. So going into this next question, I want to start with Chip on this one, because actually the original reason I reached out to Chip to do the podcast, you know, with all you guys, was I read his article on the Microcap Club about interviewing, the art of interviewing management. So I'm curious, Chip, how do you approach speaking to the management teams of Canadian companies? Is it different than when you're speaking with a U.S. company?
You know, like I said before, I don't do a whole lot in the U.S. as far as speaking to management. I do if I'm, you know, researching a company in Canada and there's maybe a competitor in the U.S. You know, usually I'll if I want to speak to management, usually I'll send them an email to try to set up a time to talk to them. I have called them kind of out of the blue in the past, but they tend to kind of be rushed if they're not expecting to block off, you know, a half hour, 45 minutes or an hour to speak with you. But, you know, I'm usually persistent because my feeling as a minority shareholder is that I'm a part owner of the company, and they should be willing to set aside some time to talk to me. You know, I'm not talking to them every week. And so I realize these guys are busy and they wear a lot of hats in these microcap companies, but I really think that they should set aside time talking to investors who've actually done a lot of research on these companies. So in general, like I said, they're usually quite accessible and willing to take your calls. So,
Well, are there any questions that are like that you specifically would ask a Canadian company, for instance?
Compared to a U.S. company?
Yeah, or any, I guess even globally.
Yeah, I'm not sure there'd be different questions. You know, when I'm talking with management, there's a few things I'm kind of looking for to kind of get their read on. You know, I'm looking for the key drivers of business, especially in their eyes, to see if that's different than what I perceive the key drivers to be. You know, I want to know how they approach capital allocation. You know, if they're a profitable company, what are they doing with to reinvest their cash? You know, I really want to know about the competitive threats to the business, and, you know, it helps me evaluate if there's a competitive advantage in the business. And so I want to know how they think about these sorts of things. What are their incentives? Are they aligned with my incentives to grow the business? You know, just trying to think about how they think about risk. So those are kind of the areas that I generally try to target. When I first started talking to management teams, I'd prepare a long list of questions, and, you know, usually I'd get through about a third of those. And so what I try to do now is kind of narrow it down to two or three of these topics that I kind of talked about and try to target my questions in those areas, because more often than not, the discussion kind of goes kind of off of what you originally, the question that you originally asked. And so, you know, I think you have to allow time for them to expand on those other areas and kind of delve into those other areas.
So, and definitely no yes or no questions.
Yeah. You know, I my healthcare training, I mean, when you go in to interview a patient, I learned 20 years ago that if you ask a closed-ended question where it's a yes or no answer, you get a yes or no answer. And if you can ask open-ended questions like, you know, if you use the words why, how, or what before, you tend to get a much more elaborate answer and you tend to get better information.
I was just going to say, unless we have, you know, I don't think any of you guys are lawyers on this dais right now, you know, then yes or no questions is totally fine. But, so I think,
leading questions either.
Oh yeah. No lead. Yeah, exactly. No leading questions, but,
maybe a lawyer would say, I'm married to a lawyer. She might say, ask leading questions.
That's good.
You'll get the answer you want.
That's funny. So I wanted to ask the same question to Brandon. Do you feel like there's a difference or in, I guess to you, how would you approach speaking with management from Canadian companies?
Sure. So I think the largest difference that you see comes in the question of, you know, how big is the company and sort of how much following do they have. So you can imagine the largest companies, say, you know, Apple, Facebook, you know, these companies have huge IR divisions, and only the largest fund managers in the world, you know, say Carl Icahn, is going to be able to get a meeting with the CEO. You can take that down all the way to the smallest microcap that can't afford to have an IR department, or sometimes they can't even afford to have a receptionist. And so in those kind of companies, you can directly phone up the CEO. And, you know, if the CEO has never heard from a shareholder in the last couple of years, you know, there's a good chance that they'll be receptive to your call, or at least be interested that someone is looking at their business. And so I think the differences come in Canada, there's just more of those small, tiny companies that are just trying to get off the ground, that don't really have a dedicated IR infrastructure. And those tend to represent the lowest barriers to getting a hold of management. And, you know, as Chip alluded to, some management teams just don't want to talk to you, but then, you know, I've found that to be a pretty big red flag to say, well, if they don't want to talk to me, then why do I want to invest money and be a part owner in the company? And so I've generally found it to be pretty accessible. You know, in my experiences, talked about some of the conferences earlier. This is, I found, the best way to get access to management. If you can get to go to one of these conferences, a lot of times they're free to go, or, you know, for a token fee, the companies usually are the ones that pay. And in these conferences, you can set up, you know, 8 one-on-one meetings a day. Over a 3-day conference, you can speak with 24 management teams one-on-one for 45 minutes to an hour, and really not having to send a single email or set up a single call. And I think that's enormously valuable, especially if a lot of the companies you're investing in or interested in are going to be there. You can really get a lot of mileage out of that. So that's how I was first able to talk with management at the LD Micro Conference in Los Angeles a few years back. And then kind of a funny story, when I got done with that conference, I said, well, I'm going to call some of these Canadian companies that weren't at the show. And so I made my first management call. It took me 2 weeks to get a hold of the CEO. And then when we were into our call, you know, they had one pretty fierce competitor in the U.S. And I asked some question halfway through that led the management team to think that I was an operative for their competitor trying to pry out information. And so then he got really defensive, wouldn't answer any of my other questions. The call ended shortly after that. I said, this is a disaster. But, you know, as Chip wrote in his post, you know, interviewing is a skill, and over time, you'll get better at it, learning how to ask the right questions, how to, you know, build rapport with management, and create a foster a constructive discussion. And so that's something that's helped over time, and management discussions are a key part of our due diligence. We won't invest without at least establishing dialogue with management.
And Philippe, I'm very interested in getting your opinion on this, because for you, there's somewhat of a language barrier. So can you care to comment?
Yes. Well, it's true that it's challenging for me to call a management team and ask questions, because sometimes some of them talk very fast and I don't initially understand all they're saying. And so I'm trying to get around that problem. First, I like to do collaborative work, so I often share ideas and research with other investors in my network, like Chip and Brendan. So what I would do would be, well, instead of calling the management each on our own, maybe we could do a conference call. So that get me more comfortable to know that there is Chip or Brendan on the line or Paul Andrella. So first I can listen to their question and answers, and I can ask mine. So this is how I do it, you know. And then when I build a relationship with the management team, I'm confident to call them on my own, you know. But I have to have that first contact. I want that first contact to go well, and this is how I do usually, or like Brendan said, I like to go in microcap conferences. So, you know, when I already met with them, I feel it's okay to call them, and they know I'm French and I'm from Montreal, and they are very collaborative.
Okay, so I only have a couple.
If I can just reiterate what Brendan and Philippe said just about conferences. I've been investing for 15 years, but it's just in the last 2 years I've started going to some of the microcap conferences like LD and the Microcap Club conference. And I think it's the best bang for your buck. Like Brendan said, you get to meet with, you know, every half hour you can meet with a different management team, and I think it's a great way just to kind of add to your due diligence.
For sure. And I agree. I mean, that's why, you know, we go to every one of these conferences. We actually even put on our conference ourselves, because we know the importance with meeting with management. It's important. You know, you want to look a guy in the eye and you want to hear what he has to say. And, you know, that's part of the process. And, you know, one thing that's interesting to me, and I only got a couple more questions for you guys, and with regard to just finding these companies. I know you said you had your sources, but, you know, for the new investor who knows little to nothing about microcap Canadian companies, you know, why have they been so undiscovered? I think let's start with Brendan on this one.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to certain stereotypes and biases that exist in the U.S. based. You know, first of all, I think, you know, the resource base is a large part of it. You know, a lot of investors in the U.S., if they're not into resource investing, they'll just assume that all of Canada is resource-focused, and they'll say, well, if I'm going to find a tech company or a healthcare company, I'm going to have to sift through 1,000 resource companies, and that's not a good use of my time, and so I just won't bother with it. Another thing that I've heard is there's, you know, been over the years, you know, egregious behavior by management teams as far as, you know, fraudulent companies, stock promotions, other things, you know, excessive options, salaries, that really turned off a lot of investors in the U.S. and given a feeling that there's less governance, you know, strength of corporate governance, there's less disclosure. And so really all that kind of leaves a bad taste in their mouth, and whether they've had a bad experience or they know another investor that's had a bad experience, they tend to just, you know, paint it with a broad brush and say, well, Canada is just not, you know, an attractive place to invest. And I think you kind of have to, you know, take the truth that's in that, but also recognize that that can't apply to all the companies. And, you know, we've been very fortunate to meet great management teams that are well aligned with shareholder incentives, that are growing their companies, that have proven to be great investments. And so I think, you know, the more that kind of thinking persists, I think the more there'll continue to be opportunities for investors looking in Canada.
And Chip, you care to chime in on this one?
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that, but I think Brandon makes a great point. I was just recently reading an article. There's a book written about the Howe Street mining promoters in Vancouver, and I think back in 1990, Forbes dubbed Vancouver the scam capital of the world, and so I'm sure some of that stigma still persists, and, you know, I don't mind that because, you know, there's a lot of good, legit companies that trade on the Venture Index and the other two indexes as well, so I don't mind competition staying out of our backyard. It makes it easier for us to find some of these undiscovered gems.
I was just going to say, you know, what are some things to look out for then currently? Because I know that was a stigma from the 90s, but I'm sure things have changed now. So what are some things to look out for both on the positive and negative side? So, you know, Philippe, let's go to you on this one.
Well, you know, when I'm researching a company, you know, I always start with the negative side. You know, I want to look into the company to see if there's any red flag, like, I don't know, for example, a company that is doing business in Latin America, Africa, China, you know, it's tough for us to do channel checks and to make sure that it's a legitimate business. So sometimes, you know, it's when I just cannot verify if, like, they have real customers, then I just stay away. So it's you know, I start with the red flags, and then I look at what the my investing criteria that I named earlier: growth, high gross margin, operating leverage, the quality of the management team, and those things, you know. But I always start with the red flags, because that's, you know, the first rule is to protect your capital, and that's the most important rule, you know. So my goal is to find an opportunity where I have limited downside but with unlimited upside. So that's how I approach I approach it.
And Chip, so you were kind of going on this train actually a little bit earlier. So what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think as far as dues, you know, I think Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist investor in the States, talks about the startup companies that he likes to invest in, where the management make the guy running the company earns no more than 150 grand a year, and that might be a little too far on the other side, but, you know, I think management's actions speak louder than their words, and so, you know, if you can go in and see the history of what they've taken in compensation, I like to own companies where management eats its own cookie and owns a lot of shares, so, you know, when they do the opposite of that and they don't own shares but they take an enormous salary, I mean, that's a red flag. You know, just looking out for what management has done compared to what they've said they would do in the past. You know, if I actually owned shares in a company a few years ago, and you know, the management, the CEO, lied about securing a line of credit, which was critical to run their business. And so I just thought the company was so cheap that it set off the negatives. And it's funny, I actually purposely didn't call him to talk to him because I thought that he could lie to me, and I still invested in the company because it was just so cheap. But I got out at a profit, but could have secured a bigger profit if I'd sold earlier. But those would be the types of red flags that I kind of look for.
How about you, Brandon?
Yeah, I think, you know, if I knew nothing else about a story, I'd want to know, you know, what percentage of the company does management own? And also, you know, how did they build their stake? And I think when you see a management team that's using their own hard-earned money, and especially if they're not taking a huge salary and buying shares, and I think back to the biggest winners we've had have been situations where not only did management own a significant stake, but in cases where there was a private placement that they, you know, say we were participating in, management was right alongside of us putting their money in. And that really aligns everybody. And so, this, you know, the same things we're seeing in the company, management seeing in the company, and it really fosters, you know, a culture within the company that if people feel like owners, they're going to do little things each day to make the company better, as far as just, instead of just showing up and taking a salary. And really, that things as an investor you can't see, you know, what's the internal culture. But when you see that happening at the top and management acting that way, assuming that will percolate through, has worked out well for us, and that's really what we've seen in companies that have worked. And I think as far as red flags and things that haven't worked, you could really just look at the opposite, where management relies heavily on options. And so, you know, options pay out if things go well, but there's no downside if they don't go well. Unlike shares, if you bought money with shares or bought shares with your money, then it's kind of symmetrical. You know, things go well, they're worth more. They don't go well, they're worth less. So, you know, options aren't the best, and Warren Buffett's talked a lot about that. And then the worst of all would be a high salary, because, you know, especially with these companies that have a small revenue base, you know, paying a management team $400,000 for the CEO is a tremendous waste of shareholder money in a lot of cases that could be put towards marketing or developing a new product. And a lot of times, the management team will just want to stay there and preserve their high salary versus doing, you know, some prudently riskier things that could grow the business and pay off for you. So I think always going on to CEDAR, reading the insider reports, you know, every year companies have to file a management information circular, which will tell you what percentage of the company that is owned by the management team, the board of directors, and any other 10% holders. If you can do some research on who those people are and how they got their shares and make a determination of, you know, are they in it for a higher share price or are they in it for high salaries, I think it will save you a lot of time and effort once you go into, you know, actually evaluating the business and the competitive advantages and all the other things that will lead towards an investment decision.
Okay, guys, we're about to wrap up, and this is my favorite question to ask at the end of every interview. And it's I want to know your guys' takeaway from this interview. You know, I want to know the one piece of advice or maybe a learning experience that you went through as a microcap investor, either specifically in Canada or just in general, that you could provide for our audience. And so I think for this, Chip, let's start with you, and we'll go from there.
Well, I think the biggest lesson I've learned over the years, and it's actually, I've learned a lot of lessons. I've made every mistake that you can make in the book. So, but I think the biggest lesson that I've learned as far as what I kind of give your listeners is from the few winners that I've had that have, you know, grown over 20 times. And I think there's a few key factors. You need great management. It's got to be a great business. And it's got to be a low price. If you can wrap that up, I wrote an article on a company called MTY Food Group for the Microcap Club blog, and that thing was 100 bagger over, I think, about 10 years. And so it had those three key ingredients, and you just have so much leverage to the upside with those situations.
At the very end there, Chip mentioned an article that he wrote for the Microcap Club where it's a case study of a 100-bagger. And what I've decided to do is I put the link in the description of it on Podbean. So you'll be able to click through and read that article from Podbean. All right. And what about for you, Philippe?
Well, my main takeaway would be the importance of networking. As a young investor, I've been only doing this for 2 years and a half, and I have to say that many of the ideas that I invested in, I didn't find them. Someone in my network reached to me to ask my opinion on the idea. So I would really recommend people that want to get in microcap investing seriously to try to build a good network, people that are smart, that you can collaborate with them. You know, it's not a one-side thing. You know, when I find an interesting idea, I reach to my network to get their opinion, and they also do it with me. So that would be my main takeaway of this interview.
All right, how about you, Brandon?
I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned is the importance of writing and the power of writing. I mean, really in life in general, but investing in particular. And I look back, and it wasn't until I really started writing that I started to accelerate rapidly as an investor, both from my performance and also my enjoyment out of it and the network that I was able to build. And I think writing really forces you to focus your thoughts. And with investing, there's so much information out there, and you're trying to build a case. Do I invest or do I not invest? And then even once you make that decision, so many things change, and you have to make, you know, decisions every day. Do you buy more, do you hold, or do you sell? And I think writing things down and having a reference to go back and look at, you know, why did I buy this in the first place? Are those reasons still intact? Will really help you make rational decisions, you know, when share prices are swinging wildly. And the other benefit of it is it really helps other people understand you as an investor and helps do exactly what Philippe was just talking about in building a network. And, you know, I've read all of Chip's work and Philippe's work, and I've learned so much. You know, I feel like every time I read one of Chip's articles, it's 15 years of investing experience, you know, distilled right into my mind. And for a young investor, I think that's absolutely critical. So if you're out, if you're investing, if you're enjoying the process, I would highly encourage you to at least keep a journal and keep your own notes there to reference. And if that's going well, then get something out in the public domain, start a blog, do a guest article. You know, you only get better over time, and it's a lot of fun to be able to look back and see what you've learned and get feedback from other people on your ideas and your experiences.
Okay, guys. So as we're wrapping up, let's I'd like to know, where can our audience go and find more information about each one of you, where to follow you on Twitter. So Brandon, let's go with you while we're still talking to you. Where can people go and subscribe to your newsletter, and where can they follow you on Twitter?
Sure. Yeah, we're that small cap discoveries, kind of all strung together, .com is our newsletter. We've got educational content. You can subscribe right there on the website. And our Twitter handle is smallcapdisc, so that's Discovery shortened. So you can follow us on Twitter and keep up with us.
How about you, Philippe? Where can we go and follow more information about eSpace?
On my blog, the address is eSpaceMC.com, and I also have a Twitter, so this is our your followers can know more about me.
What is it? It's at eSpace, right? At eSpace MC?
Yeah, right.
Okay. That's at eSpaceMC. And Chip, where can we go and follow you for more information?
Yeah, my Twitter handle, I don't tweet a lot, but it's at microvalue. And I'm a guest contributor on Microcap Club on the educational blog site there. And I'm a guest contributor on Philippe and Matthew's eSpace blog. I've been promising Philippe an article for 3 months here, so I'm going to get around to it the next week here. So,
well, that was my fault. It's because I've been hammering you to get on here for the podcast. So, Philippe, it's my fault. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. Have a great weekend, and I look forward to seeing you all soon.
Sounds good, Bobby. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Bobby.
Bye.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Chip, Brandon, and Philippe again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast, go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap Podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap Podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, where we'll have our next week in review and have another exciting guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.